create a lot of havoc, lynching an innocent black man and tormenting the townsfolk of Rosewood. The angry mob destroys nearly every home and other structure in the town. There are some heartbreaking subplots, but mostly the story hinges on a little white lie, so to speak. It's all very distressing, and the injustice of what happened in Rosewood is, at times, unbearable, because it is based on a true story. The first time I saw Rosewood, I turned to my friend and said, "I don't want to see a white person for 3 days." She said, "That's not fair." But she was white, so that was to be expected. Fortunately, it was a Friday, so I locked myself in my apartment, and by Monday, I was mostly ready to re-engage with the world. If Rosewood demands a 3-day window of voluntary segregation, The Help demands 3 weeks, maybe longer. Watching historical movies about the black experience, or white interpretations of the black experience, have become nearly impossible for the same reason I hope I never read another slave narrative. It's too much. It's too painful. Too frustrating and infuriating. The history is too recent and too close. I watch movies like Rosewood or The Help and realize that if I had been born to different parents at a different time, I too could have been picking cotton or raising a white woman's babies for less than minimum wage or enduring any number of intolerable circumstances far beyond my control. More than that, though, I am troubled by how little has changed. I am troubled by how complacently we are willing to consume these often revisionist stories of this country's complex and painful racial history. History is important, but sometimes the past renders me hopeless and helpless. When I first saw the trailer for The Help, I was not familiar with the book. The moment I saw the first maid's uniform grace the screen, I knew I was going to be upset. By the end of the trailer, which contained all the familiar reductive elements of a movie about the segregated South, I had worked myself into a nice frothy rage. In the following months, I continued to see the trailer, only now it was plastered all over the internet and on television, and the reprinted tie-in book version was heavily hyped, even climbing back to the top of the Amazon bestseller list because this is one of those books nearly everyone seems to love. After seeing the movie, I borrowed the book from a friend, read it, and raged more. The Help is billed as inspirational, charming, and heartwarming. That's all true if your heart is warmed by narrow, condescending, mostly racist depictions of black people in 1960s Mississippi, overly sympathetic depictions of the white women who employed the help, the excessive inaccurate use of dialect, and the glaring omissions with regards to the stirring civil rights movement in which, as Martha Southgate points out in Entertainment Weekly, white people were the help. The architects, visionaries, prime movers, and most of the on-the-ground laborers of the civil rights movement were African American. The Help, I have decided, is science fiction, creating an alternate universe. Hollywood has long been enamored with the magical Negro, the insertion of a black character into a narrative who bestows upon the protagonist the wisdom he or she needs to move forward in some way. Or, as Matthew Huey defines the phenomenon in a 2009 article in Social Problems, the magical Negro has become a stock character that often appears as a lower-class, uneducated black person who possesses supernatural or magical powers. These powers are used to save and transform disheveled, uncultured, lost, or broken whites, almost exclusively white men, into competent, successful, and content people within the context of the American myth of redemption and salvation. See Ghost, The Legend of Bagger Vance, Unbreakable, Robin Hood, Prince of Thieves, The Secret Life of Bees, Sex and the City, the movie, The Green Mile, Corinna, Corinna, etc. In The Help, there are not one but 12 or 13 magical Negroes who use their mystical powers to make the world a better place by sharing their stories of servitude and helping Eugenia Skeeter Phelan grow out of her awkwardness and insecurity into a confident, racially aware, independent career woman. It's an embarrassment of riches for fans of the magical Negro trope. The theater was crowded for the screening of The Help I attended. Women came in groups of three or four or more, many of them clutching their well-worn copies of the book. As we waited for the movie to start, and a long wait it would be because the projector was malfunctioning, a sign, perhaps, I listened to the women around me, certainly well-meaning, many of them of the Golden Girls demographic, chattering about how much they loved the book and how excited they were and how long they had been waiting for this movie to open. I wondered if they were reminiscing about the good old days, then decided that was unfair of me. Still, they were quite enthusiastic. My fellow moviegoers applauded when the movie began, and they applauded when the movie ended. They applauded during inspiring moments and gasped or groaned or clucked their tongues during the uncomfortable or painful moments. Their animated response to the movie was not mild. My faith in humanity was tested. I was the only black person in the theater, though to be fair, that mostly speaks to where I live. As I walked to my car, I came to the bitter realization that The Help would make a whole lot of money and be really well received by many. If you go to the theater without your brain, leave it in the glove compartment. The Help is a good movie. The production is competent, the cast is uniformly excellent, and includes the immensely talented supporting cast of Cicely Tyson, Allison Janney, and Sissy Spacek. Both Viola Davis and Octavia Spencer received Oscar nominations because they do excellent work in the movie and Hollywood loves to reward black women for playing magical Negroes. Spencer would go on to win, and deservedly, the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. While I wondered how so many talented people signed on to this movie, the cast is not the problem here. As others have noted, The Help is endemic of a much bigger problem, one where even today a prime role for a two-time Tony Award winner and one-time Oscar nominee like Viola Davis is that of a maid. Davis, who is always sublime, brings intelligence, gravitas, and heart to the role of Abilene Clark, an older maid who has just lost her only son to a mill accident and has worked her whole life as a maid and nanny, raising 17 white children. When we meet her, Abilene is mourning her son and working as the maid for Elizabeth Leifolt and her daughter, May Mobley, a chubby, homely girl who is often neglected by her mother. Abilene's magical power is making young white children feel good about themselves. Whenever May Mobley is feeling down, Abilene chants, "You is kind. You is smart. You is important." She showers the child with love and affection, even while having to listen to young white women discuss black people as a subhuman species, dealing with the indignity of using a bathroom outside of the main house, and coping with her grief. Magic, magic, magic. At the end of the movie, Abilene offers her inspirational incantation to young May Mobley, even after she is fired for an infraction she did not commit, because that's what the magical Negro does. She uses her magic for her white charge, and rarely for herself. Spencer is also formidable as Minnie Jackson, the sassy maid, where sassy is code for uppity, who works at the beginning of the movie for the petty, vindictive, and socially powerful Hilly Holbrook, Bryce Dallas Howard, president of the Junior League. Hilly Holbrook's claim to fame is, among other cruelties, proposing an initiative ordering all white homes to provide separate bathrooms for the colored help. After Minnie is fired from her job where she uses her Negro magic to look after Hilly's elderly mother, she goes to work for Celia Foote. The women of the Junior League in Jackson ostracize Celia because she was pregnant when she married, is considered white trash, and has committed other petty social sins. Minnie uses her mystical negritude to help Celia cope with several miscarriages and learn how to cook. And at the end of the movie, the narrative leads you to believe that Celia indirectly empowers Minnie to leave her abusive husband. As if a woman of Minnie's strength and character couldn't do that on her own. Then Celia cooks a whole spread for Minnie and allows the help to sit at her dining room table just like white folk. Oh, shucks. Minnie asks, "I'm not losing my job?" And Celia's husband says, "You have a job here for the rest of your life." Minnie, of course, beams gratefully because a lifetime of servitude to a white family, doing back-breaking work for terrible pay, is like winning the lottery and the best a black woman could hope for in the alternate science fiction universe of The Help. Emma Stone plays Skeeter, who has just returned to Jackson after graduating from Ole Miss. She gets a job as an advice columnist for the local paper, but she has bigger aspirations and a whole lot of gumption. We know this because she sasses her mother and doesn't make finding a man her first priority. Her first priority is to give grown black women a voice. Being back in Jackson forces Skeeter to confront many of the social norms she has taken for granted for most of her life. While her friends baldly treat The Help terribly, Skeeter sits silently, rarely protests, but often frowns. Her frown lets us know that racism is very, very bad, and that good Southern girls should be nice to their mammies. Skeeter gets the bright idea to tell the stories of the maids who spend their lives cleaning white people's houses, raising white people's babies. Stone is charming and believable, even if the character she plays is willfully ignorant. The charm, though, grates, because it is fairly obscene to imagine that this wet-behind-the-ears lass would somehow guide the magical Negroes to salvation through the spiritual cleansing of occupational confession. When Abilene reminds Skeeter they shouldn't be seen together, Skeeter briefly educates herself on Jim Crow laws and then ignores whatever she learned, imposing herself on Abilene's bewildering goodwill, urging her to share her story about what it's really like to be a maid in Jackson, Mississippi, as if the truth were not plainly obvious. At the end of The Help, Skeeter offers to turn down her dream job in New York City so she can stay and protect Abilene and Minnie. We're supposed to see this as a heartwarming gesture, but it only brings the movie's overall condescension into bitter relief. The Help is, in the absence of thinking, a good movie, but it is also an unfairly emotionally manipulative movie. There are any number of times during the interminable 2 hours and 17 minutes of running time when I felt like my soul would shrivel up and die. I was devastated by all of it. Everyone around me cried openly throughout most of the movie. My eyes were not dry. I am certain we were often crying for different reasons. Every transgression, injustice, and tragedy was exploited so that by the end of the movie, it was like the director had ripped into my chest, torn my heart out, and jumped up and down on it until it became a flattened piece of worn-out muscle. Cardiac jerky, if you will. The movie is emotionally manipulative, but in a highly controlled way. The Help provides us with a deeply sanitized view of the segregated South in the early 1960s. There are many unpalatable moments, but they are tempered by a great deal of easy humor and contrived, touching emotional moments. The movie gives the impression that life was difficult in Mississippi in the 1960s for women, white and black, but still somewhat bearable because that's just how things were. The implausibilities in the science fiction universe of The Help are many and wild. Certainly that happens in most movies, especially these days. What makes these implausibilities offensive in The Help is that most of us know better. We know our history. There is not enough height in the atmosphere for us to suspend our disbelief. If you do bring your brain to The Help, the movie is worse than you might imagine. Seeing The Help through a critical lens is excruciating. At one point, while teaching Celia Foote to make fried chicken, Minnie says, "Frying chicken tend to make me feel better about life." That a line about the solace found in the preparation of fried foods made it into a book and movie produced in this decade says a great deal about where we are in acting right about race. We are nowhere. That line was one of many that made me cringe, cry, roll my eyes, or hide my face in my hands. To say I was uncomfortable is an understatement. Little things also grate. The over-exaggerated dialect spoken by the maids evokes cowed black folk shuffling through their miserable lives, singing Negro spirituals. In Abilene's home, for example, there are pictures of her recently deceased son and a portrait of white Jesus. After Medgar Evers is shot and JFK attends his funeral, the camera pans to the wall where a picture of JFK joins the other two. Not, say, a picture of Medgar Evers himself or another civil rights leader. In another subplot, of which there are many, Skeeter's childhood nanny, Constantine, Cicely Tyson, is so devastated after being fired by the white family for whom she worked for more than 27 years, she dies of a broken heart. The gross implication is that her will to live came from wiping the asses and scrubbing the toilets of white folks. This white wish fulfillment makes the movie rather frustrating. Men, black and white, are largely absent from the movie. White men are apparently absolved from any responsibility for race relations in 1960s Mississippi. The movie is devoid of any mention of the realities of the sexual misconduct, assault, and harassment black women faced working for white men. We see nary an unwelcome ass grab. I don't think lynching was brought up once. We don't know how Abilene came to have a son, so we're left to assume, because she is magical, that her child's conception was immaculate. Minnie's husband, whom we never see, is abusive. We hear her being abused during a phone call, and toward the end of the movie we see Minnie's bruised face. But we never see Leroy, the man who has committed these acts of violence. There is also the bizarre subtext that the woman with sass is the one who has to be kept in line through brutality. As in most popular portrayals, black men are dealt with in depressing, reductive ways when they are addressed at all. This movie shamelessly indulges in the myth of the absent black man. The actual consequences of black men consorting with a young white girl are glossed over as merely inconvenient instead of mortal. The white women are portrayed as domestically tyrannical while living highly constrained lives as desperate Southern housewives, so we can sympathize with their plight. Race is regularly handled ineffectually in movies and fiction. I have become accustomed to this reality, and yet. I have struggled with writing about The Help because there is something more to my anger and frustration. At first I thought I resented the fact that a deeply flawed book has sold more than 3 million copies, spent more than 100 weeks on the bestseller list, and is a major motion picture. but books I don't like do well all the time. I don't lose sleep over it. I also cannot deny that the book and movie have their moments. There were times when I laughed or was moved, though certainly those instances were few and far between. I think of myself as progressive and open-minded, but I have biases, and in reading and watching The Help, I have become painfully aware of just how biased I can be. My real problem is that The Help is written by a white woman. The screenplay is written by a white man. The movie is directed by that same white man. I know it's wrong, but I think, how dare they? Writing difference is complicated. There is ample evidence that it is quite difficult to get difference right, to avoid cultural appropriation, reinscribing stereotypes, revising or minimizing history, or demeaning and trivializing difference or otherness. As writers, we are always asking ourselves, how do I get it right? That question becomes even more critical when we try to get race right, when we try to find authentic ways of imagining and reimagining the lives of people with different cultural backgrounds and experiences. Writing difference requires a delicate balance, and I don't know how we strike that balance. I write across race, gender, and sexuality all the time. I would never want to be told I can't write a story where the protagonist is a white man or a Latina lesbian or anyone who doesn't resemble me. The joy of fiction is that in the right hands, anything is possible. I firmly believe our responsibility as writers is to challenge ourselves to write beyond what we know. When it comes to white writers working through racial difference, though, I am conflicted and far less tolerant than I should be. If I take nothing else from the book and movie in question, it's that I know I have work to do. I don't expect writers to always get difference right, but I do expect writers to make a credible effort. The Help demonstrates that some writers shouldn't try to write across race and difference. Catherine Stockett tries to write black women, but she doesn't try hard enough. Her depictions of race are almost fetishistic, unless they are downright insulting. At one point in the book, Aveline compares her skin color to that of a cockroach. You know, the most hated insect you can think of. Aveline says, staring at a cockroach, "He big, inch, inch and a half. He black, blacker than me." That's simply bad writing. But it's an even worse way of writing difference. If white writers can't do better than to compare a cockroach to black skin, perhaps they should leave the writing of difference in more capable hands. In The Help, Stockett doesn't write black women. She caricatures black women, finding pieces of truth and genuine experience and distorting them to repulsive effect. She makes a very strong case for writers strictly writing what they know. Not what they think they know, but actually know nothing about. Surviving Django. I was as tense about seeing Django Unchained as I was seeing The Help. It doesn't help that so much of the black experience, particularly in movies, is mediated through the vision of white writers and directors, as if they are the most qualified to speak to black history. Who then want to be congratulated for their efforts, no matter how mediocre those efforts might be. This mediation, its constancy and impoverished quality, gets old. As expected, I was the only black person in the audience during the screening I attended of Django Unchained. When the movie opens, five male slaves are being herded, on foot, wearing little to protect them from the elements. Their backs bear the evidence of their torment. Thick braids of scar reaching from their shoulders down to their lower backs. Most movies about slavery reveal the camera's, director's, predilection for depicting the broken bodies of slaves, as if only through such visual evidence can a viewer truly understand the horrors of human bondage. It is night when these shivering, suffering slaves and their overseers run into Dr. King Schultz, Christopher Waltz. A dentist, he calls himself. He talks real fancy as he explains that he's looking for a slave named Django, Jamie Foxx, who, Schultz hopes, can identify the Brittle brothers he's looking for. Schultz is charming and suave in the ways of the European, showing up the American slave dealers as the ignorant men they are. It's easy to laugh during these early moments, despite the men, practically naked and bound together by shackles, shivering in the frigid night cold. It's a relief to laugh because then we can forget that just beyond the verbal sparring, there is a deeply uncomfortable history waiting to be told. After a negotiation of sorts, Schultz buys Django and frees the other slaves, who dispatch the remaining slave dealer before heading, well, who knows where. This story isn't about them. Schultz and Django head to a Texas town where everyone stares agog at a black man on a horse. The unlikely pair soon install themselves in a saloon, the owner having run to get the sheriff because slaves are as unwelcome in drinking establishments as they are on horses, and thus begins the first of several plots throughout the movie. There is action and humor and an anemic love story. There is no shortage of killing, with elaborate blood spurts arcing through the air, accompanied by the moist, hollow sounds of bullets landing in human flesh. At the end, there is, we are led to believe, a happy ending. And through it all, we're supposed to believe that what writer-director Quentin Tarantino has created is art. From the beginning, the audience around me laughed quite heartily. What was particularly disconcerting is how they were laughing at the wrong times. Some of the laughter was nervous tittering during the first instances of the N-word being bandied among characters. As the word's usage became ubiquitous, that laughter grew heartier while there was silence during the movie's subtler and far funnier moments, like when Django explains to Calvin Candy, Leonardo DiCaprio, that Django's business partner, King Schultz, offered to pay for a runaway slave because he was not used to Americans. When the movie's dark humor focused on people who looked like them, the audience was silent. I became paranoid. Were the people around me gleeful because they could enjoy hearing the word being used without consequence? Were they, like moviegoers during The Help, longing for a different time? But there might be a better way to start this conversation. Any offense I take with Django Unchained is not academic or born of political correction. Art can and should take liberties and interpret human experiences in different ways, even if those interpretations make us uncomfortable. My offense is personal, entirely human, and rising from the uncomfortable reality that I could have been a slave. There's no denying I would have made a terrible slave, either in the big house or in the fields, which means slavery would have been extra unpleasant for me. I can't debate the artistic merits of Django Unchained because the palms of my hands are burning with the desire to slap Tarantino in the face until my arms grow tired. Or I could start by saying that offense isn't even the word to best describe how I felt while watching Django Unchained, which I have now seen twice. Offense is far too mild. Most movies these days offend me with their very mediocrity. Django Unchained disappoints, irritates, and at times angers and inflames. It is also impossible to discuss Django Unchained without discussing the N-word, used so ubiquitously in the movie. Tarantino seemingly believes the N-word to be a new conjunction, a part of speech that connects two words, phrases, clauses, or sentences together. To be fair, I hate the N-word and avoid using it because the N-word has always been a pejorative, a word designed to remind black people of their place, a word to reinforce a perception of inferiority. I have no interest in using the word to describe myself or any person of color, under any circumstance. There is no reclamation to be had. There are 110 instances of the N-word in nearly 3 hours, something Tarantino seems to believe is historically accurate and therefore justified. Had Tarantino used historical accuracy as a guide in every aspect of Django Unchained, one might take his weak explanation seriously, but this is a movie that also includes, among other oddities, a moment with a slave merrily enjoying herself on a tree swing on a plantation run by a man named Big Daddy, while nearby, another slave is about to be beaten. When Tarantino suggests he is trying to achieve verisimilitude by infusing his script with the N-word, I cannot help but feel he is being disingenuous, or, at the very least, rather selective about how and where he chooses to honor historical accuracy. Certainly, the N-word is a part of our history as much as it is part of our present. The first documented instance of the word dates back to the 1600s, and it has since appeared in nearly every aspect of American life, from legal documents to entertainment to our vernacular. American presidents and Supreme Court justices and average citizens have used the word with equal comfort. As Randall Kennedy notes in Nigger, The Strange Career of a Troublesome Word, a complete list of prominent whites who have referred at some point or other to blacks demeaningly as niggers would be lengthy indeed. It would include such otherwise disparate figures as Richard Nixon and Flannery O'Connor. The N-word is certainly not a word that has, as many suggest, been kept alive solely by hip-hop and rap artists. White people have been keeping the word alive and well, too. Any movie about slavery or black history could reasonably include the word a few times just to remind us of how terrible we all used to be, to remind us of the work we have yet to do. And still, the televised version of Roots manages to depict the realities of slavery without the N-word, and the miniseries is nearly 10 hours long. I knew from the start I wasn't this movie's target audience. Racism and slavery aren't terribly amusing to me, unless Dave Chappelle is running the show. In truth, I am exhausted by slavery. Thinking about it, talking about it, reading about it, and seeing movies about it. Each time I hear of a new book or movie that takes up slavery in some way, I feel mostly dread. What more could possibly be said on the topic? But Django Unchained isn't even really a movie about slavery. Django Unchained is a spaghetti western set during the 1800s. Slavery is a convenient, easily exploited backdrop. As with Inglourious Basterds, using World War II, Tarantino once again managed to find a traumatic cultural experience of a marginalized people that has little to do with his own history and used that cultural experience to exercise his hubris for making farcically violent, vaguely funny movies that set to right historical wrongs from a very limited, privileged position. Like most westerns, like most movies for that matter, Django Unchained concerns the whims of men. The movie is at times brilliant, but mostly infuriating. It is a good movie in that masturbatory way most Tarantino films are good. The man knows his craft and clearly loves movies and loves to make movies where he shows us all just how much he loves movies. Hollywood, for whatever reason, is more than happy to indulge Tarantino's self-referential homage to those filmic genres with which he is so intensely enamored. Still, I found myself enjoying certain parts of the movie. Strange as it may seem, the movie's sound design is impeccable. I needed something to focus on so I wouldn't lose my temper, so I paid real close attention to those sound effects. Fine work is done there. The acting is solid, as is the direction and set design. The script is particularly strong and certainly worthy of critical respect and the Oscar nomination it received. There are a few particularly intelligent bits of dialogue, like when Django and Dr. King Schultz go to a plantation owned by Big Daddy, Don Johnson, who has to instruct a slave, Bettina, about how to treat Django as a free man. She says, "You want I should treat him like white folks?" That, of course, flusters Big Daddy, who says, "No, of course not." And Bettina, rightly confused, says, "Well then, I don't know what you mean." This is how Tarantino works. He tries to make you forget his many offenses by lulling you into complacency with his competence and flashes of brilliance. He tries to make the viewer believe that if the art is good enough, the message can be overlooked. I tried to overlook the message, but Tarantino never let me. Each time I tried to settle into the movie and enjoy myself, he made another indulgent, obnoxious choice that did little more than reveal what I can only assume is Tarantino's serious problem with race. Christopher Waltz was, as he always is, a revelation. His character as a European struggling to understand American culture reveals the absurdity of slavery and gives the movie at least one white person who isn't wholly hateful. But he is still complicit in slavery, using the system to his advantage in the early going. Schultz tells Django he will only free him after they successfully capture the Brittles. Schultz finds slavery abhorrent, unless it suits his purposes, which is, I imagine, the dilemma many white people found themselves in during the slavery era. Django isn't given the autonomy to decide for himself if he wants to help Schultz or not, and we're still supposed to go along with this. We're still supposed to root for Schultz, not because he is the best person, rather, he is the least evil. I suppose that's the point Tarantino is trying to make, that in the 1800s, everyone was complicit in the institution of slavery, but he does a half-assed job of getting that point across. And then there is his hero, Django. Fox does a fine job as Django, but his character is largely one-dimensional, which is a shame because his character provides a rich opportunity to explore what finding freedom might look like. Instead, Django mumbles a few moderately amusing lines about killing white people. When he gets to choose his own outfit, thanks, Massa, he picks a bright blue fop of a suit that makes the audience laugh at the simple Negro rather than with him. Then, toward the end of the movie, he is somehow self-actualized and has regained his dignity, just like that. Django really has one goal in the movie, to find and free his beloved wife, Broomhilda, Kerry Washington, who was also sold at a slave auction. Some reviews have suggested that Django Unchained is a love story, but that is simplistic, wishful thinking. Broomhilda is, like most of the people of color in this movie, rather incidental. She has barely any screen time and speaks very few lines. At various points, we see Django imagining Broomhilda in the distance, smiling at him with her eyes. We learn she speaks German, which delights Schultz because, really, what are the odds? Tarantino spends an inordinate amount of time gleefully depicting the suffering of the movie's rarely seen or heard heroine, Broomhilda, as she is branded, flogged, punished in a hot box, and humiliated during a dinner by being forced to reveal her scars to dinner guests. Mostly, she looks pretty or tormented or prettily tormented as the situation demands. We hardly get to see a loving moment between Django and Broomhilda, even though their story is supposed to be the movie's centerpiece. One thing we know about slavery is that in order to survive, some black people did what they had to do, and sometimes that meant becoming a part of the slavery system so that said system wouldn't break them all the way down. Samuel L. Jackson, who frequently appears in Tarantino movies, makes a deeply disturbing turn as Stefan, an irascible right hand to Calvin Candy, one part butler, one part household overseer, one part world's crankiest hype man to his master. We're supposed to hate Stefan because he's about as bad as the white people. Jackson plays the role so convincingly that we do indeed come to hate Stefan. There's no acknowledgement, however, of why Stefan might have become so cruel. There's no acknowledgement that surrender was his only choice or that we should feel as sympathetic toward Stefan as we do toward Django or Broomhilda or any of the other enslaved people in the movie. What struck me most was how Django Unchained is a white man's slavery revenge fantasy, one where white people figure heavily and where black people are largely incidental. Tarantino's arrogance, as always, is impressive. Django is allowed to regain his dignity because he is freed by a white man. He reunites with his wife again with the help of a white man. Django Unchained isn't about a black man reclaiming his freedom. It's about a white man working through his own racial demons and white guilt. There is no collective slavery revenge fantasy among black people. But I am certain if there were one, it would not be about white people. Not at all. My slavery revenge fantasy would probably involve being able to read and write without fear of punishment or persecution, coupled with a long vacation in Paris. It would involve the reclamation of dignity on my own terms and not with the generous assistance of benevolent white people who were equally complicit in the ills of slavery. I could also start by saying that in Haiti, January 1st not only ushers in a new year, it is also the day Haitians recognize as Independence Day. On that same day in 1804, Jean-Jacques Dessalines declared Haiti a free nation, the first of its kind in Latin America, ending a 13-year slave rebellion. Since then, Haiti has been a troubled country, but her people have been free, or as free as anyone can be while trying to overcome the complex legacy of slavery. As a first-generation American of Haitian descent, I was raised with stories of how my ancestors fought for freedom, and how no matter what burdens we may suffer as a Haitian people, we know we set ourselves free. I am Haitian, but I was raised here in the United States. You cannot know my heritage just by looking at me. I'm black in America. Like many people who share my skin color, slavery is this terrible, looming thing that is part of an inescapable distant past. Instead of offering me some new insights on this troubling reality, Django Unchained simply served as a reminder that the more things change, the more they stay the same. Beyond the Struggle Narrative. Hattie McDaniel, the first black person to win an Oscar, did so for her role in Gone with the Wind as Mammy in 1939. McDaniel was a formidable actress, but for better or worse, her career was dominated by roles as maids because, in that time, domestic servitude was the only way popular culture could conceive of black women. In 2012, Octavia Spencer won an Oscar for playing a maid, Minnie Jackson, in the popular but deeply problematic The Help, which received 4 Oscar nominations. While there's a lot of shallow rhetoric about post-racial America, when it comes to the Oscars, Hollywood has very specific notions about how it wants to see black people on the silver screen. There are certainly exceptions, but all too often critical acclaim for black films is built upon the altar of black suffering or subjugation. In 2013, we saw quite the cinematic parade of black suffering and subjugation. In the excellent Fruitvale Station, writer-director Ryan Coogler deftly tells the story of the last day of Oscar Grant's life before Grant was murdered by a BART officer on New Year's Day, 2009. Lee Daniels' The Butler chronicles the life of Cecil Gaines, a black butler in the White House for 34 years. Through the story of Gaines's life, we also learn the story of black America, the challenges of desegregation, and how with dignity one man persevered. The pinnacle of black suffering, though, comes by way of 12 Years a Slave. Since the movie's debut on the festival circuit, it has enjoyed massive critical acclaim. It's the movie everyone must see, the definitive accounting of America's brutal legacy of slavery. Such rhetoric is always curious because slavery has been well accounted since the early 1800s. What more could possibly be said about slavery? Who has labored under the impression that slavery is anything but an abject horror? 12 Years a Slave offers a relatively original conceit, the true story of Solomon Northrup, a free black man, who was kidnapped and sold into slavery for 12 years. As Michelle Dean notes for FlavorWire, if on no other grounds, 12 Years a Slave is remarkable because it is the only film to date that is based on a slave's own account of his experience. The movie is also the first major studio-backed slavery film helmed by a black director. These milestones are not insignificant. Despite the source material and the director, however, 12 Years a Slave does not offer new insight into the slave narrative. There is little to justify this movie's existence beyond the filmmaker's desire to tell this particular story. I chose not to read many reviews before seeing 12 Years a Slave. I wanted as unadulterated a viewing experience as possible. I confess, I was not impressed, and I do not understand the effusive acclaim. The movie was brutal, almost mind-numbingly so. Nothing was spared in portraying the harsh realities of human enslavement, the loss of dignity, the physical, sexual, and emotional violence. The reality depicted is so harsh, I cannot help but wonder if people find the movie excellent because of the sheer relentlessness. I cried more than once, but I was not moved. I was simply broken, the way anyone would be broken by witnessing such atrocities. 12 Years a Slave is a good enough movie, certainly worth seeing if you're unclear about slavery and its legacy. The actors acquit themselves formidably. Director Steve McQueen makes some lovely artistic choices, but at times those artistic choices are jarring and out of place. Extended poetic shots of plantation beauty. Overindulgent cinematic pauses that make no sense. The movie drags on at times, the boredom only interrupted by yet another unbearable violence. Black women's suffering is used to tell a man's story. Though Northrup is himself the victim of senseless brutality, it is more often the women who suffer, and Northrup who becomes more miserable by being forced to bear witness. It is his suffering that is painted as more profound. Yes, this is his story, but great swaths of the movie focus on everyone but him. Early on, Eliza, played by the immensely talented Adepero Oduye, has been separated from her children, an alarmingly regular occurrence during the slave era. Eliza is so overcome with grief she can hardly bear it. She spends most of her time sobbing, inconsolable. Solomon questions her grief sharply and offers some pabulum about wanting to survive. Before long, Eliza is sold off, because no one wants to share in her pain or be forced to see it. Solomon is seemingly unmoved by this turn of events, which begs the question, which comes up often, of why the subplot has been included. In the second half of the movie, Solomon is sold to Edwin Epps, Michael Fassbender, who is renowned for his ability to break slaves. Epps is insane and unrepentant. He has a predator's fondness for Patsy, Lupita Nyong'o, whom he reveres and abuses in equal measure. Ultimately, Patsy's suffering is the most devastating in a movie where nearly everyone suffers. So profound is her misery that Patsy begs Solomon to kill her so that her suffering might end. He declines, which is as cruel as it is understandable. It should be noted that 12 Years a Slave does a remarkable job of revealing the ways in which white women were complicit in slavery. Sarah Paulson is absolutely chilling as Epps' wife, Mistress Epps. Epps acts like a jealous lover whenever Patsy is not within his reach and does not bother hiding his feelings from his wife. Mistress Epps resents Patsy for the place the woman holds in her husband's heart and misses no opportunity to direct cruelty toward Patsy. Most movies about slavery have a fetish for depicting the mortification of black flesh, and 12 Years a Slave is no different. There are a number of scenes where slaves are whipped for one infraction or another. When Solomon is first captured, he is taught his place with a beating. Slaves are punished for not picking enough cotton. The most harrowing scene is one where Patsy is punished for going to the neighboring plantation for a bar of soap with which to clean herself. Epps is so angry and sick with jealousy, he finally brings himself to whip Patsy. But then he can't do it. He hands the whip to Solomon, who is reluctant to take part in this brutality, but well aware he has no choice. Solomon does his best to mete out his master's punishment, but in the end, Epps is not satisfied. He takes the whip from Solomon and uses it on Patsy himself. By the end of the scene, she is barely conscious, her back rent open and bloody. The scene is visceral, as it should be, but it also feels gratuitous, because the scene is not designed to amplify Patsy's plight. The scene is designed to amplify Solomon's plight, as if he is the more tragic figure in this situation. I do not want to diminish the suffering of anyone during the slave era. Men and women were subjected to unspeakable atrocities. Solomon Northrup's story is particularly troubling because it shows how vulnerable all black people were, free or not. What I resent in 12 Years a Slave is how the suffering of women is used to further a man's narrative. There is, for example, a rape scene that carries little narrative relevance. Patsy lies inert beneath Epps. It's a repulsive scene. So in that regard, McQueen has done his job. But it doesn't seem essential to the movie because the primary story is not Patsy's. It's a gratuitous, unnecessary reminder that, yes, women were raped during the slave era. Ultimately, Solomon Northrup is freed because he has finally gotten word to his family in New York that he is alive. The moment, like much of the movie, is strangely muted. We're clearly supposed to feel something, but it's hard to know quite what to do with that emotion. Before Solomon leaves the Epps plantation, Patsy runs into his arms and they embrace. We know nothing of what happens to Patsy, beyond what we might imagine, because she has already done the necessary work of staying on the sidelines while Solomon is dispatched unto freedom once more. My reaction to 12 Years a Slave is born largely of exhaustion. I am worn out by slavery and struggle narratives, I am worn out by broken black bodies and the broken black spirit somehow persevering in the face of overwhelming and impossible circumstance. There seems to be so little room at the Hollywood table for black movies that to earn a seat, black movies have to fit a very specific narrative. Movies like Love and Basketball, or The Best Man and The Best Man Holiday, are perhaps not Oscar material, but they are certainly movies that also capture the black experience, and somehow, they are often overlooked in conversations about serious movies. Filmmakers take note and keep giving Hollywood exactly what it wants. Hollywood showers these struggle narratives with the highly coveted critical acclaim. It's a vicious cycle. There is no one way to tell the story of slavery or to chronicle the black experience. It is not that slavery and struggle narratives shouldn't be shared, but that these narratives are not enough anymore. Audiences are ready for more from black film, more narrative complexity, more black experiences being represented in contemporary film, more artistic experimentation, more black screenwriters and directors allowed to use their creative talents beyond the struggle narrative. We're ready for more of everything but the same singular stories we've seen for so long. Not everyone is ready for this change, however. 12 Years a Slave received 9 Oscar nominations and won the 2013 Oscars for Best Performance by an Actress in a Supporting Role, Best Writing, Adapted Screenplay, and Best Picture. The Morality of Tyler Perry. Tyler Perry loves to tell a good morality tale. Whether his movies or stage plays are offering up what goes for humor in Perry's universe, by way of Perry in drag as Medea, or chronicling a wealthy man learning how to be true to himself and others, or following tight-knit friends as they weather the trials of marriage, there is always a lesson to be learned, one supported by fidelity, fortitude, faith, and a touch of fire and brimstone. Tyler Perry would have us believe that his conception of God is in everything. He has been writing plays and films since he was 22. Perry's start was modest, staging his first play at a community theater, and less than a decade later, his plays were a popular mainstay on the Chitlin circuit. In 2005, he wrote and produced his first movie, Diary of a Mad Black Woman. Since then, Perry has been a box office success, his films grossing more than $500 million. Perry's rise is noteworthy for many reasons, not the least of which is that he understands real power in Hollywood lies in the complete ownership of creative work. Perry writes, directs, produces, and often stars in his movies. He has several television projects in production and a lucrative distribution deal with Lionsgate Films. He owns and runs Tyler Perry Studios, the rare black-owned production studio in the United States. He has collaborated with kingmaker Oprah Winfrey and counts among his coterie of friends any number of influential and important people. In many ways, Tyler Perry seems unstoppable, and to see a black man achieve this kind of success in a notoriously exclusive and predominantly white industry is laudable. I cannot bring myself to say more than that, though some might call Perry's success inspiring. The problem is that Tyler Perry is building his success on the backs of black women and the working class by using them all too often to teach his lessons, to make his points, or to make them the butts of his jokes. In many of Perry's movies, women are not to be trusted. Women are regularly punished in these movies, whether by abuse, addiction, or adultery. While there are good women in his films, there are so many bad women, women who are unfulfilled by their lives and or marriages, and are then punished when they try to find fulfillment. An unspoken message all too often is, you should be grateful for what you've got. Temptation features a fairly talented cast, including Journey Smollett-Bell, Lance Gross, Vanessa Williams, Brandy Norwood, and, perhaps most oddly, Kim Kardashian.